Welcome to News in Focus with your host, Chris Long, president of the Ohio Christian Alliance. Stay tuned for an analysis and conversation about the issues that matter most to you and your family. Here now with this week's edition of News in Focus is Chris Long.
And good evening and welcome to this edition of News in Focus. We're glad that you've joined us. Those of you who have listened to this program for some time know that we have focused on the plight of the Iraqi Christians in northern Iraq that since ISIS invaded in August of 2014 and had to flee the towns and villages and the city of Mosul itself, a city of about the size of Columbus, Ohio, about 600,000 residents, and they've had to flee into Kurdish territory, and that is where many of them are held up at this time. But as we speak, the last assault for western Mosul is underway by Iraqi forces and, of course, U.S.-backed Iraqi forces to take out the last strongholds of ISIS. And the story that's emerging from Iraq is not pretty. In fact, it is devastating. They are using the remaining residents that are there in western Mosul as human shields, and there's a lot of atrocities that are going on as we speak. You're listening to News in Focus, a broadcast of the Ohio Christian Alliance. And with us on the program tonight is an expert in someone who served in Iraq. It's Lieutenant General Mike Barbero. General Barbero was director of Joint Improvised Explosive Device Defeat Organization. He was responsible for leading the Defense Department's actions to rapidly provide counter-IED capabilities in support of combat commanders, military services, and other federal agencies to enable the defeat of the IED as a weapon of strategic influence when he was in Iraq. Of course, he has had a long, illustrious military career. He is now retired, but he is anything but sidelined. He's been back and forth to the Middle East and travels extensively and lectures, and we've had him on the program a number of times to give us his thoughts as to what is happening. General, welcome to the program.
Chris, thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Well, General, I saw the report, actually, that Greta Van Susteren, she went over with Franklin Graham during the Easter holiday and gave a report on NBC, or MSNBC is her new broadcast channel, which is a whole new audience, which I was thankful for that she showcased that and said, you wonder why I would spend Easter holiday. It's because we've been focusing on the plight of Iraqi Christians, Christians in the Middle East, and especially those who have suffered under the hands of ISIS. You and I have talked in recent programs about the assault on Mosul, and we were concerned as to what was going to take place when the final push for Mosul was eventually launched, which, of course, it's been on for months now. Tell us your thoughts and analysis of what you see as it's unfolded. How have things gone overall?
Well, things have gone as expected. You know, I've said all along, this is going to be a long, tough fight. Urban warfare, when a defender has had 2 years of time to prepare his defenses and is ruthless and ready to die as ISIS is and ready to do, you know, any extreme actions, human shields, executions, whatever, it is going to be, it has been and will be a tough fight to root them out, dislodge them from Mosul, which is their last big sanctuary in Iraq. So they're in a fight to the death. They've had time to prepare, and urban conflict just eats up people and supplies and time. So it's not over by a long shot.
Well, in fact, there were reports on Sunday that there was some type of gas attack that was used on civilians within their sector as there was a push on for western Mosul. And it's basically street-to-street fighting right now to retake the western portion of the city. Are they surrounded at this point?
Pretty much. There may be a few we call rat lines for them to get in and out, but not very much. But they've had 2 years to prepare, and one of the sayings in the military is the benefit of time accrues to the defender. So they've had time to prepare buildings, tunnels, reinforcing positions. And it's not just a street by street, Chris. It's room by room at this point. And it's tough. But, you know, ISIS will get pushed out of there. It's just going to take time. And then you know, my biggest concern is the day after Mosul. What do we do? What do we do to help Iraq with the future? What do we do to help the Christians, but also the Sunni population there and everyone whose areas have been absolutely devastated by these barbarians calling themselves ISIS? So the real challenge is the day after Mosul. What do we do as Americans to help there, to help rebuild, to help prevent the next ISIS from coming in? Or my greatest fear is Iranian domination, which we're starting to see.
Well, that's right. And of course, we do have U.S. personnel on the ground as advisors. We don't know to what extent they're actually engaged. We do know that we've taken some casualties. What's the current Pentagon policy as far as troops on the ground in Iraq in aiding the Iraqi forces in the retake of Mosul?
Well, I mean, we are on the front lines. We've been there. I've run into some of our special forces, you know, a year ago, up front in calling in fire, adjusting airstrikes, and communicating with U.S. support forces. And now we have an artillery battalion in northern Syria to provide indirect fire support to our allies there. So they're involved. I mean, we're taking casualties. Our special operators are doing raids. You know, it's a fight for intelligence. So they're doing these raids to not just to go after the individual, but to get their laptops, their cell phones, to get intelligence on this. So we are in there, and, you know, between 6,000 to 8,000 troops total in Iraq. So we're involved supporting the Iraqi forces and some of the local allies, like the Kurdish Peshmerga.
Citizens or civilians in the city have tried to escape, but ISIS is brutal. They don't want them to leave. They want to use them as human shields. Here in the Associated Press report just the other day, it says more than 300,000 civilians are still trapped in Mosul. ISIS has kept them there to prevent the U.S. and Iraqi forces from launching airstrikes and mortars against their fighters. How is it being conducted now? Has rules of engagement somewhat been adjusted accordingly with ISIS using human shields?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, rules of engagement are not this fixed thing, you know, set in stone. They're adjusted based on the conditions, the enemy, the friendly situation. I mean, for a time when I was in Iraq, we had meetings every night to change them because the situation was so fluid, just like it is here. So I guarantee you, you know, Americans, we're always going to be concerned with and err on the side of protecting the population and limiting collateral damage. So absolutely, this is making it a very complex battlefield, more complicated. How do we target these guys when they're doing these things with human shields and using the population as a tool?
Well, of course, and it's not a perfect science. There's definitely going to be collateral damage. There's going to be some human tragedy along the way to get rid of the bad guys, as there was in all wars, World War II as well, with
right.
French civilians dying when the invasion of Normandy was underway. But they knew what that was, some of the unfortunate things that took place to liberate the area. You know... it says this week, Iraqi military dropped leaflets over ISIS-held areas, telling civilians to try to stay in their own homes, an almost impossible requirement as ISIS herds civilians out of their own houses and deeper into the heart of the city. You know, these reports that we're getting and the brutality, I mean, hanging on light poles of individuals, of shootings, of groupings of people, it's almost like Nazi-like era-type atrocities as the Allies closed in on the Germans. It seems as if, and the Nazi forces, it looks like ISIS is doing the same thing. They're getting closed in on, and the more that things, the inevitability of them being eliminated from Mosul, they're going to take down as many civilians as possible. It appears that's the case. What's your thoughts?
Well, they've demonstrated no regard for human life, no regard for civilians, and you know they're worse than what we've ever seen before as far as the executions and just the sheer brutality and disgusting ways they treat non-combatants. They see them as a tool, and they have no regard for human life. It's a foreign practice from what we as Americans and Christians know, and you just have to deal with it and account for it and factor that into your planning and how you go about your business. And that complicates things, and it's going to make it a longer fight because we're not going to target areas where we know there are civilians. So we just have to account for that. But ultimately, they'll be dislodged from Mosul and will be defeated. We're seeing that. It's just going to be a long grind.
Kurdish forces, are they involved in this campaign?
Absolutely. They're holding the northern shoulder. They've liberated part of Mosul. They've got a 1,000-kilometer front at one time with ISIS. So they've been involved from the start, from the summer of 2014, and have been our best and most loyal allies in the region. And I'll tell you something, Chris, something I testified before Congress on this disastrous Iran deal several weeks ago, and my point was the real enduring threat to U.S. interests in the region is Iran and their proxy forces on the ground in Iraq. The Kurds have said this will be our next fight with these Iranian proxy forces, and we're seeing it from Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq, how Iran has their proxy forces on the march in Bahrain, in Yemen, and they're confronting all of our allies and friends in the region, whether it's Saudi Arabia, Israel, the Kurds, and that's the enduring and longer-term threat. I talked about the day after Mosul, and we have to reckon with that. Iran is not our friend, they're not our partner. They are diametrically opposed to us in every way, and they're our enemies, and we need to realize that and not be held hostage by this disastrous Iran deal that was passed.
Well, the current administration is reworking that deal right now, we're told, in Washington. So, I mean, that they're going to get out of it. They're going to rework it and just say no agreement. But again, like you said, it depends on who's on the ground, who's actually implementing policy once Mosul does fall, and then the repatriating of refugees. In fact, in the Kurdish territories, upwards of 3.5 million refugees that left northern Iraq for the safety of Kurdish territory when ISIS invaded. What happens with these folks that are still living in limbo? In refugee camps?
Well, some of them will go back and some of them won't. I mean, a while ago I met with the Archbishop in Erbil, who was there and kind of shepherding the flock of Christian refugees there. And many of them said, we won't go back because, you know, Christians have been under assault in the Middle East for over a decade now. And so that's very troubling. Some will go back, but again, when they see these Iranian proxy forces, these Shia militias that are loyal to Iran, and,
right.
and they're conducting atrocities against the Sunni population, any Christians they find also. So there will be some refugees go back, but I'd be surprised if Christians or Yazidis in large numbers or even Sunnis are concerned about the day after Mosul.
During the Obama administration, we tried to bring a visa processing center in for into the Erbil area. The administration at the time, the Obama administration, said that these people had to go to the embassy in Baghdad, which was at the time traveling through 200 miles of enemy-controlled territory under ISIS, which it was an impossibility. And yet, there were European states that were opening to numbers of refugees, and somehow it got blocked, and again, by the Obama administration. How do you see it changing with the Trump administration and actually aiding or helping or supporting efforts by European countries also taking in Chaldean Christians who seek to travel elsewhere and maybe find another home? Not just the United States, but in Europe.
Yeah. Well, first, at the strategic level, there's greater engagement. General Mattis, Secretary Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, was in Saudi Arabia yesterday, reassuring them and supporting them in this their fight against these Iranian forces, the Houthis in Yemen. Secretary Tillerson has made similar trips there. So strategically, our friends and allies in the region, I was in Israel 4 weeks ago, and they're very comforted. They said they welcome the Trump administration and the leadership and the focus on supporting its friends in the region. So I think that it's a very positive, being very received very positively across the region by our friends there. This new administration and this fresh look. You know, one of my contacts during the Obama years said, "Who would have thought that the United States would treat their friends like enemies and their enemies like friends?"
Right.
And I see the Trump administration working to reverse that and put it back on a normal course, where we recognize the threats in the region, we recognize our friends, and we exert American leadership to confront our threats and support our friends. So that strategic I see is positive, and it's viewed optimistically across the region. I'm not familiar with the specific policies in changing the refugees and our reception, so I couldn't really address that.
You and I had an opportunity over a year ago, almost 2 years now, to the U.S. Chamber held a reception for President Barzani of Kurdistan, and he obviously opened up his doors in his territory to house the hundreds of thousands, and it ended up being 3.5 million refugees that came, and there was no place to house these people. Now, of course, talking to some of the folks here in the stateside, the Chaldean Christian community, they were able to provide temporary housing, different trailers and obviously units that would provide for housing. But at first it was a humanitarian crisis. Things have somewhat settled out somewhat. But again, these are people with no home. I mean, they can't go back home right now. And there's no way, there hadn't been any way forward. They were kind of locked in. What do you see as a long-term goal now of what might happen with the refugees there in Kurdish territory?
Well, some of them will go back to some of these areas, as I said. Some will not. And the Kurds can't shoulder this burden indefinitely. They have an economic crisis because of the war, because of the drop in the oil prices. And the Kurds' economy is tanked. And so they need, just because ISIS is pushed out of Mosul, we cannot forget the longer-term challenges, the plight of these refugees. So we need to continue to push for our government to come up with a policy to help our friends. Jordan is the same boat. They've got tremendous refugee challenges, and their economy has been suffering. So I think, you know, for your listeners, keep the pressure up with your elected officials for a longer-term policy here, and that deals with this refugee crisis. And how do we support our friends who have been shouldering this burden during the Obama years by themselves without much support from the United States?
In the next year or so, the Trump administration is going to have the opportunity to appoint its own embassy officials around the globe, but specifically in this region. Who is the ambassador of the United States to Iraq right now? Or is there one?
There is. Ambassador Silliman has been in there for probably coming on a year. And he's an experienced ambassador, was an ambassador in the region Kuwait, immediately prior to this. So we have he's a very, very good, very experienced. Our previous ambassador, Stu Jones, had been the ambassador in Jordan. So we have an experienced ambassador in place, but he can only execute the policies that come from Washington. His hands are tied. So hopefully, as the Trump administration takes root and reverses and puts in place some correct policies, we'll see it reflected on the ground there.
Well, that's right. Well, they inherited so much right away, and Secretary of State Tillerson is very busy, and of course, there's been this air assault on in Syria at the air base, and it seems like the administration is wanting to say, look, we're not going to sit on the sidelines; we're going to take action. But I think he's been measured. I was a little concerned right away. I didn't want us getting involved with Syria. But I think that it was a very measured attack, and it kind of reset the table. From a military perspective, how do you see how things have been handled so far?
I think appropriately. I mean, I went into Iraq in 2003 and spent a total of 4 years there, and then we pulled out. Afghanistan, we've been there for a long time. So the military is not the right solution, and certainly occupying these countries without an end state or a strategy is not the solution. And so we've got to be careful when we commit American sons and daughters on the ground that we're there to win and there's a strategy. And so, but his approach with limited support, the right support, I feel, in the fight in Iraq and Syria has been appropriate with special operators and others. Hitting the Syrians after their latest use of poisonous gas was appropriate. It damaged them. It set them back and sent a message not only to them but to their Iranian and Russian partners in this. So and the last thing we want to do is get on the ground in Syria in large numbers. That is just a mess, and I don't see a solution for it. So I think I'm very encouraged with the use of force has been limited, but has been meant to send strategic messages and support our friends and allies, which has been lacking the last 8 years.
Well, that's good to know, and of course, we respect your opinion immensely. We're talking to Lieutenant General Michael Barbero, who is retired and is now busy traveling and speaking and lecturing. Tell us some of your recent travels and what you've been engaged with. Obviously, over there in the Middle East and Iraq and the Kurdish people, but where else have you gone?
Well, I was in Saudi Arabia earlier this year, and they're fighting, as I said, these Iranian surrogates. But I have an interesting trip, Chris, is I was in Israel about a month ago and to study Hezbollah with an international group of senior military leaders. And we went to the Syrian border, the Lebanese border, met with all the Israeli leaders to include President Netanyahu. And again, I keep coming back to this, but Iranian surrogates, in this case Hezbollah in Lebanon, have taken over the control of Lebanon, and they have 100,000 rockets and missiles aimed at Israel. And Israel talks about the next fight with Hezbollah, the next Israel-Lebanese war, but not in the terms of if, but when. So that was very profound to get up on these borders, and you could actually hear the fighting in Syria and talk to our Israeli friends and hear how, you know, they continue to live under the threat of these people. So that was eye-opening and something we need to think about.
Well, obviously, one of the challenges in the near future, what we're going to have to deal with, these rockets that are in Lebanon, what's the capacity of these rockets? Are these larger than the Katusha rockets that of days gone by that these random strikes that would take place in Israel? What type of weaponry do they have now? What would be the effect?
They have gotten, obviously, when Israel went to war with Lebanon to stop the rockets in 2006, I think there were less than 20,000 rockets, maybe 10,000. Now there's 100,000 by Israeli estimates. With increased range, increased precision, they can threaten Tel Aviv, shut down the international airport, threaten the northern ports of Israel, through which 99% of their goods and trade passes through. And Israel has great defenses, very technically competent, but they can't meet the quantity of this rocket and missile threat. So it is, poses an almost existential threat to Israel, and it's something they're going to deal with. They're not going to wait to get hammered, and they're not going to wait for the international community to try to limit them. They are going to deal with the threat to their people, which is now very, very troubling.
Well, one in which we'll be watching very closely, of course, praying for the state of Israel. General, you've been very accurate in your prediction. Obviously, this assault on Mosul, and thankfully it's almost over, but we need to pray for those who are still in that section of the city that is still under ISIS control, and it looks as if their brutality is going to continue until they're liquidated from the scene altogether, and we'll be watching very carefully. General, thanks for being my guest today. I appreciate it so much.
Great. Chris, thanks for the opportunity, and thanks to all your great listeners who support these organizations and support our troops. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your service to our country. God bless you.
Thank you. You too. God bless you and your listeners.
Thank you. Well, we're glad that you've taken this time to listen to the program. Those of you will be staying standby. We'll be taking a break. We'll be coming back on the other side with Joseph Kassab of the Iraqi Christian Advocacy Organization. If you want to learn more about our organization, you can log on to our website at ohioca.org. If you missed any of today's interview with retired General Lieutenant General Michael Barbero, you can also catch it there as well. We'll see you next week. God bless.
You have been listening to News in Focus with your host, Chris Long, President of the Ohio Christian Alliance. To learn more about the issues that matter most to you and your family, visit online at ohioca.org. That's ohioca.org. Thank you for listening. This program is sponsored by the Ohio Christian Alliance of Akron, Ohio. Welcome to News in Focus with your host, Chris Long, President of the Ohio Christian Alliance. Stay tuned for an analysis and conversation about the issues that matter most to you and your family. Here now with this week's edition of News in Focus is Chris Long.
Okay, and we're back, and we're going to continue our discussion on Iraq and the crisis there. And with me on the phone is Joseph Kassab, who is the president of the Iraqi Christian Advocacy and Empowerment Institute. And Joseph Kassab is from the greater Detroit area, but he has been working in Iraq, of course, with the Chaldean Christian community there. And as we talked earlier in the program with General Mike Barbero and the crisis in Iraq, let's continue with Joe about what's happening on the ground. Joseph, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Well, Joe, it's been a long 3 years since 2014 when ISIS invaded northern Iraq and sacked the capital city of northern Iraq, Mosul, and, of course, took the weaponry there, the capital bank, I think, was $600 million in it. Of course, the 600,000 residents in greater Mosul area, not to include the towns and villages surrounding it, many Christian towns and villages, and of course Christian citizens, along with Sunnis and Yazidis, and it's been a long, dark night since the Islamic State invaded northern Iraq. What's your feelings right now as you see that Iraqi forces, along backed by U.S. forces, are finally closing in on the last vestiges of the ISIS stronghold in western Mosul?
Well, first of all, I just want to say that we are very grateful for United States, U.S. Army for getting engaged with the Iraqi Army to support them in any way they can to fight ISIS in Mosul. And Mosul is part of the Nineveh province, which is the second largest city in Iraq. And as you already said earlier, there are a lot of, hundreds of thousands of people who fled the area because of this particular violence and the presence of ISIS in there. And there are a lot of minority groups there that are really taking it on the chin, and they are the guys who are getting hurt the most, especially the Christians, the Yazidis, and some other smaller groups are there. So we started to see that people are fleeing this violence, but at the same time, they're not coming back. And there are many reasons for them not to come back, and because they don't trust the area. Or the, in other words, the area itself is not well cleared of ISIS, that's number one. And number two, we know also that majority of the buildings and the areas are there. There are booby traps, and there are a lot of ID devices everywhere, in that area. Let me speak a little bit more about the Nineveh Plain, because the Nineveh Plain is the largest area of Mosul, of Nineveh province. It is the size of Lebanon. Let's put it this way. and there are like hundreds of Christian Yazidi villages there, and majority of them are empty now. Although ISIS was driven out of these areas, and there are many reasons for people not willing to go back, and one of them is they feel that the area is not ready for them yet, number one. But number two, they don't feel there's something for them to go back. And also they feel that there are people whom they lived with and they shared life together in that area. They betrayed them badly. And they are the people who told ISIS to go and, mark the homes of the Christians with the letter N, means noon in Arabic, which means Nasrani. Nasrani means Christian. So all these homes were taken. And after ISIS was driven out, these homes are either booby traps or destroyed. So there is nothing for people to go back. So there are a lot of things we are asking the U.S. administration to do for us, and so is the international community, in order for people to go back. It is not easy. There is a lot of fear, a lot of violence. And that violence is very unique violence. Let me tell you about it. This is sectarian violence. It's a violence not between ISIS and the Iraqi troops, or what we call them, the People Army, but also it is between the Shiites and the Sunnis.
Right.
The Shiites make the largest number of the People Army, which we call in Arabic al-Hajj al-Shabi. These people are targeting Sunnis, are targeting minorities, and they are not there only to liberate from ISIS. And this is something we're very much dismayed about. And as a matter of fact, I think Abadi was talked, the prime minister of Iraq, when he came to the United States, he was talked about that. We don't want the People Army because they are loose, they are not organized, and they are backed up by Iran. And that is something, it is not to the favorite or interest of everybody in the area.
Right. They're backed by Iran. They're Iranian forces backed
right,
by them.
Right.
You know, General Barbero was just on the program, and he was talking mm-hmm. about that and how that's a growing problem in the region.
Sure.
And so, obviously, you're hearing it firsthand from your folks mm-hmm. on the ground that are in the refugee camps. Go on.
Chris, as a matter of fact, I just finished talking to people on the ground there from the leadership, and they are on the front and the front lines, and some of them are in Kurdistan, and they are very, very unhappy with what's taking place in Nineveh province at this time.
Well, that's discouraging because obviously this whole thing with ISIS and getting rid of them, and we're on the brink of that. But of course, the Associated Press was reporting that things are getting darker as the circle is enclosed around them in Mosul. And of course, they are encircled at this point. There's no exit for them. Now, the Kurdish territory is where a lot of the Iraqi Christians fled to, and they're in refugee camps. What is the number of Iraqi Christians currently in Kurdish territory in refugee camps?
Well, let's put it this way. All people from Nineveh Plain, and majority of them are Christians, also there are a good number of Yazidis. But for Christians, I would say anywhere between 180,000 to maybe 250,000. They're all in northern Iraq, in Kurdistan, getting some support from the governor of Kurdistan, being protected. But until when? That's the thing. But let me go back to the area that was liberated. It's really important for your listeners to understand that although we defeat ISIS, we defeated ISIS, and ISIS is in its way out. Maybe it is. I don't know. Okay. We fought ISIS, but the thing that we did not do, and that's what I want the U.S. administration to understand, and we always keep telling them this, by the way, is we need to defeat their ideology. Their ideology, the backward ideology, it is spreading like fire in Iraq, okay? So that ideology is very vicious, extremist Islamic ideology. Sharia law is ideology. This is something that's going to stay in Iraq for a long time, and I see that the people of Iraq, even the good ones, are supporting that ideology. So this is not good for us, this is not good for anybody in the area, and this is not good also for the Westerns who come and try to help the community.
Now, there was projections at one point in the Kurdish territories, somewhere upwards of 3.5 million refugees. Does that include not just the those who evaded ISIS in northern Iraq, but also in Syria?
That is correct. We have a good number of Syrian refugees in Iraq that are protected also by the Kurds. And the Kurds are very overwhelmed with the whole thing. So their number, the number of a population in Kurdistan, it is mushrooming and mushrooming in big and large, you know, numbers. And I'm not sure at one time or another, if Kurdistan doesn't get help from the international community, I don't think they will be able to cater to the whole population.
Now, 2 years ago, Senator Rob Portman from Ohio, along with a group of other senators, was pushing the Obama administration to place a visa processing center there in Erbil, the capital of Kurdistan. They were saying, well, we want them to go to Baghdad where our embassy is. Well, that was ridiculous because that was traveling through 200 miles of enemy-controlled territory at the time with ISIS-controlled territory. So it was improbable for those people to travel through that area. And, you know, to ask those people to do that was outrageous. But eventually we did push and we did get a visa processing center there in Erbil. How are the processing of visas going right now of those who want to go not only to the United States but other places?
Well, let me explain. This process requires also the presence of United Nations or UNHCR, and they need to work in tandem with them because UNHCR is the referring agency to the processing center in Erbil. Now, the processing center in Erbil, although, as you said, started, the process is very, very anemic. And they have good reasons, and that is security background check and staffers and appropriation and all kind of things. So I have not seen it really accelerated, to be honest with you. And I need to see also the engagement of the UNHCR, which is the refugee arm, the refugee resettlement arm of the United Nations, to start the work, identify the people, spare their beliefs, spare their faith, otherwise, spare their race, spare their whatever, in order, and spare their magnitude of persecution, in order to be referred to the processing center. At this time, this is not happening, and we are a little bit worried about that. Now there are resolutions in place for another idea that we proposed, and one of the resolutions was introduced by U.S. Congressman L.C. Hastings from Florida. The congressman with his colleagues are proposing that for those who are beneficiaries of a petition to come to the United States as immigrants, they also can be beneficiaries of what we call family unification program, which is a humanitarian program. We call it P2 program that we need to accelerate, and there are a lot of people who can qualify for that, especially the Christians. Why is that? Because the Christians, they have relatives in the U.S. who are U.S. citizens, and they have the right to petition for their family members.
Okay.
If that program is revived, we had this program before, by the way, and we managed to bring in a lot of people based on that, and they are very prosperous people now. They are living in peace, and they are contributing big time to our society here in the U.S. So we need to see restart of the P2 program, and I'll tell you something about the P2 program. P2 program certification means I myself, for instance, I have a brother and I want to petition for him to come to the United States, which I have a right to do that,
right,
by the Constitution. And then my brother becomes a beneficiary. Then the beneficiary of that, for humanitarian reasons, the State Department and Department of Homeland Security jointly agreed that they can interview that person, my brother, and if he fits the criteria, then he will be shipped to the United States as a refugee. Now, this person, my brother, for instance, I'm just giving an example. My brother, when he comes here, he is related to me. He's linked to me. I've been in the country, for instance, for 4 years. Okay? I've been doing good here. I can be good to be into society. I've been loyal to this country. Okay, this is my country. Okay, so my brother, when he comes in, I'm not going to bring in a brother that he is doing really bad and he's a terrorist to ruin my reputation. I'm going to bring in somebody like me. And that is why the vetting for these people is going to be faster, and it's going to be more accurate, and it'll be less, there's non-harmful to the United States of America.
Okay.
If that program is considered, it will be one of the best of the best. By the way, I helped in asking for this program since the days of the late Senator Kennedy, and then the State Department, then the Department of Homeland Security, and took us some time to put it together. But with the approval of the Congress, we managed to get people coming here.
Okay.
And none of them to prove to be a terrorist.
Right, right.
Has intention to hurt this country.
Let me bring in Nathan Colasso. Nathan, are you there?
I'm here. I'm just I'm learning more and more from Mr. Joe Quesada today.
Yeah, that's right.
Actually,
we both are. Nathan Colasso. Nathan, you've had a number of new registrants at your school. Tell us about that have come from the Middle East.
The process has been slowed down after the cut in number of refugees from 110 to 50,000, but they're slowly still coming in. Actually, just about a week ago, we had a Chaldean family that came in that was from the Bartella area of the Nineveh Plains. So they're coming in, they're resettling, and we're trying to do what we can to help them integrate into American society successfully.
Nathan, again, tell us what's the specialty of your school there in Greater Detroit and what you do?
Well, we run community-based programs here just outside of Detroit. So we put a primary focus on family resettlements. And what I mean by community-based is we work outside of the scope of your traditional K-12 school. So we provide resettlement services, refugee services. We provide legal aid, behavioral health specialists, in addition to some services like transportation, door-to-door, uniforms, supplies, backpacks, things like that. So the idea here is to make sure that the students are, the barriers are lifted from families and students so that when they sit on their desk in the morning, they are completely focused on learning.
And, of course, many of these students have been in refugee camps for several years, have lost some time in the classroom, and, of course, have come out of war zones or have been chased, for instance, by ISIS. And so these kids have been through a lot. And so for them to be able to come to the States and to be in your school is a big deal. It's a great blessing to them, is it not?
It is. Some of them are... They are comfortable speaking about their experiences. Some are not. You know, we encourage some of the students to open up and to talk about what they've gone through just because so many of their classmates have also been through the same exact thing. And when they know that the person sitting next to them has had a similar experience, it develops more of a comfortability pattern with them. But for that purpose, we have two behavioral health specialists in the building full time. To help with that, with those types of accommodations. The stories are heartbreaking, and there are people like Mr. Joe Kassab and a number of other members of our community here, and of course your church has helped out, that have done what they can to help ease the burdens that these families have faced.
Well, that's right, and we continue to pray, and we talked with retired General Mike Barbero earlier in the program to give us an update of what was happening now in the final phases of the retake of Mosul. But the new problem, of course, on the ground is these Iranian-backed militias and soldiers and what problem that might pose for the future. So it's after ISIS is exited out of the theater of northern Iraq, what comes next? And of course, that's why we need engagement and good policy, national policy from the state side, that things not degenerate, but that there be some kind of normal, that's kind of a strange word for that region, because things haven't been normal for a long, long time. And of course, we're praying.
The last time I was on, I had alluded to this problem of you know, the Maliki-influenced militias.
Yes.
They have taken the security checkpoints, taken over the security checkpoints of some of our major villages. You know, the village of my dad and Mr. Kassab was being controlled, and I believe till this day is still being controlled by these Maliki-influenced militias. So this is creating a dilemma with the Iraqi Christian community because they don't really trust anybody else to be sort of the protectors of their villages. They want that power to reside with them. And for the most part, some of the established sub-militias that they have within the Peshmerga and the Iraqi security forces. So we have made light of the situation. Human Rights Watch has detailed this extensively. And we're moving forward. Actually, today, a piece was just released by the Church in Need, Aid to the Church in Need, that did an assessment on the Christian villages in the Nineveh Plains. And they've determined that it's going to cost about $200 million just to restore the homes that were burned, looted, or completely destroyed.
And Joe, that's what you referred to as the caliphate was announced. They marked every Christian home with an N, meaning Christian, and of course it became a target for raiding, looting, and burning out. So these folks that are in refugee camps now, to go back to what? To a house that's rubble or booby-trapped. And then, of course, who's actually in control of these areas? All these questions remain to be answered. Some do not want to return. Nathan, Joe, some want to move not just the United States, but other European countries as well. How many other European countries are open to taking some of the refugees?
Joe, you want to answer that, or you want to?
I'm gonna
have my two cents on this, and I think Nathan, you wanna come in on that too, if you like. I don't see the European countries; they are as open as used to be anymore. I see there are some resistance to the refugee community. We're hoping that Germany and France and also Sweden continue to take some of those refugees. And the reason for that is because these people, they are asking not to have them sent back home. They are saying that we don't want to go back. We have horrible memories there. We don't see a future for our children there. Nonetheless, the international community steps in and provides protection, economic development, and what have you. This has not been happening. As if anything, the central government of Iraq, it is careless, it is very weak, it's frail, and it's unable to protect its people and itself. You think it will be able to protect the minorities? I very much doubt that, and that's why people, they elect not to go back, a lot of them. But we encourage them to go back if there's an opportunity, and if all these conditions we're asking for, to have it in place. If that is the case, then we 100% push for our people to go back home. But I doubt it, and I don't see it in the very foreseen future.
Nathan, your
thoughts? We haven't been able to get a consistent percentage or stats on the people who want to come return back to their villages or
right.
who want to leave for another. And there's been a lot of variance, and a lot of that has to do with politics. There are some groups that insist on preserving the community there. For example, our patriarch of Iraq, he asks and encourages people to stay. And then there are some other groups that feel like it's more beneficial for these people to have life in the Western world. I agree with Joe, the European countries, primarily France, Germany, they've some of the politics have gotten involved, and they've been more reluctant to take in some of the refugee populations and some of the refugee communities there. But let me be frank here. No one does the job as good as the United States. And the reason why is because the United States, they set a cap on it every year, and they know how to properly integrate these communities successfully. These people are given the proper tools, and they are surrounded by organizations who help, Lutheran Social Services, Caritas, Catholic Charities. These are groups who have a wide array and a huge track record of integrating ethnic communities into the United States. When you're talking about a place like Germany, which has taken in 1 million refugees over the past 6-7 years or so, it's much more difficult there for a refugee to get on his feet and to turn his life into something that could resemble anything successful. So we do push for Western countries to take in more refugee populations. However, what then? We got to make sure that there's a follow-up and that these communities are given the tools that they need to live lives that were taken from them by radical militants.
I've been interested and surprised that there hasn't been any discussion of the UN creating a safety zone in this area, which was affected by ISIS, so that it's not just who then will become the kingpin, as it were, once ISIS is gone. And that's where the question seems to remain. So you have all the various groups of Sunni, Shiite, Christian, Yazidis, and also the Kurds. It seems to me for the populations that were driven from their homes to return back, there needs to be a safe zone. Who would be responsible for setting that up? Certainly not the Iraqi central government. It remains to be seen how much the United States would be involved. What do you foresee, Nate?
Well, I'm encouraged personally with the, I know that seeing our troops on the ground in places like Iraq and Syria is something that a lot of our citizens just don't want to happen yet. But I am encouraged to hear about some of the upticks in the troop levels there, because for that very reason, where once Mosul is liberated,
yes,
our people specifically will not trust anybody to keep them safe.
Okay.
Unless it's a non-Iraqi affiliated.
Well, we've run out of time, and we're going to pray for that. Joseph Kassab, thanks for coming on. Nathan Kalasha, we're going to have you back on, and we're praying, and we're really, our love is with those folks, and we're going to see what we can do. God bless you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Again, if you've missed any of today's program, you can hear it in its entirety at our website at ohioca.org. Good night.
You have been listening to News in Focus with your host, Chris Long, president of the Ohio Christian Alliance. To learn more about the issues that matter most to you and your family, visit online at ohioca.org. That's ohioca.org. Thank you for listening. This program is sponsored by the Ohio Christian Alliance of Akron, Ohio.